while events at the jail had been reaching this grim conclusion, Ginger had embarked on a desperate course of action. A course which had started back at the aerodrome on his return to the office with the long-awaited coffee. He was just in time to hear Delaney accuse Biggles of the murder of old Mose, and quickly he realized the desperate nature of the trap into which the airman had fallen. On the spur of the moment, he could think only of his freedom and the dire necessity for immediate action. If he could get into the air, he would be safe. Dropping everything, he dashed for the Jupiter. At 1,000 feet, he turned the aircraft, wondering where to go. Looking down, he could see the little group marching off towards Fort Beaver and the jailhouse. Still circling and climbing steadily for height, Ginger switched his thoughts to the immediate future. What ought he to do for the best? He could see no point in going to Moose Creek. He thought of Angus, but realized that with the freeze-up, no power on earth could get the Jupiter there and back. Suddenly he remembered the isolated log cabin where the Winkel had landed on its way down from Moose Creek. It was not far away, and there was just a chance that he might find something there. Something that could possibly bear out the story Biggles would tell. The true story. Satisfied he was at least doing the best thing possible, Ginger swung the Jupiter round until its nose pointed northwest, the direction of the cabin. Eventually Ginger picked out his objective. The cabin looked pathetically forlorn, he thought, in its desolate surroundings. He did not bother to taxi up to it. Switching off the engines, he glanced around and jumped out. As there was no sign of life, Ginger started walking briskly towards the cabin. He was still about 20 yards away when a strange noise stopped him short. Suddenly, he saw something emerge from the cabin window. A split second later, he realized what it was. A rifle barrel. Before he could even move, the rifle cracked. For a brief instant, Ginger swayed on his feet. Then he crashed forward on his face and lay still. The cabin door was thrown open, and the Indian member of McBain's gang emerged, holding a smoking rifle in his hands. He strode towards the motionless figure with a cat-like tread, then stopped and leaned the rifle against a tree stump. Drawing a vicious knife from his belt, he advanced confidently towards his victim. With his lips parted in a savage smile, the Indian bent over Ginger. With a sudden grunt, Ginger sprang to his feet, for he had not been killed by the Indian's shot. He had felt the whistle of the bullet as it passed his cheek, but had dived rather than fallen to the ground, hoping that the man who had fired at him would be deceived and might give the pretended corpse the chance to turn the tables. The Indian had instinctively leapt back at Ginger's unexpected return to life, giving Ginger the chance to pull his gun. However, before he could pull the trigger, the Indian knocked the weapon aside with a lightning sweep of his arm. The automatic described a short flight through the air and came to rest on the turf some 10 yards away. Ginger made a rush for it and reached it at the precise moment the Indian grabbed the rifle. Both weapons came together and two loud reports rang out, one following the other so closely that the sounds blended. Both shots missed their targets. Before Ginger could refire, the Indian had whirled around and was now running rapidly for the shelter of a belt of timber. Furthermore, as he ran, the Indian bent low and twisted and turned in a manner that made shooting with a pistol a waste of powder. Still running, the Indian disappeared from sight amongst the fir trees. The surprise of his encounter with McVane's Indian had left Ginger not a little shaken. Moreover, he saw that it was going to be difficult to search the cabin thoroughly and, at the same time, keep a lookout for the redskin. To make matters worse, the light was failing. It would soon be dark. He took a pace forward, then stiffened suddenly as a dreadful cry was borne to his ears. It was the howl of a wolf, and at the long-drawn cry, Ginger's blood ran cold. Again came the ghastly howl, nearer this time, and before it had come to a quivering end, it was taken up by others. Ginger forgot the Indian. He forgot everything. His one instinct was to head for the shelter of the Jupiter. The next instant, he was flying for his life in the direction of the machine. A chorus of howls broke out behind him, and a frantic glance over his shoulder told him the worst. A line of black shapes had broken cover and was streaking after him. He ran as he had never run before. And as he ran, Ginger knew that his life depended upon a relatively trivial circumstance. The walls were so close behind him that if the cabin door of the Jupiter was shut, he would not have time to open it. He couldn't remember whether he had closed the door or left it open. Nor could he see until he was within a dozen paces whether it was open or shut. It was open. With a last convulsive effort, Ginger leapt at the aperture and slammed the door behind him. Just as the leading wolf launched itself through the air, it struck the door with a crash that made the machine rock. Ginger, still half crazed with panic, sank down in the control seat. He was tired. He was cold. He felt weak and hungry. In fact, he was sick of the whole business. Things seemed to be going from bad to worse. With a glance out the window at the wolves, he decided to stay where he was, at least until morning. Searching about, Ginger found a few pieces of broken biscuit, and it was while he was munching these ravenously that he noticed a change in the behaviour of the wolves. One by one, they had broken away from the Jupiter and were now circling the log cabin, howling loudly. Seeing they were all looking upwards, Ginger too raised his eyes. Conspicuous against the snow on the roof was a man, and there was only one man likely to be in such a place at such a time, the Indian. As he watched, Ginger saw the Indian slip twice, and each time climb back to the ridge with an effort. He wondered why the man did not fire at the wolves, but watching his hands, he knew the reason. The Indian had dropped the rifle in his haste to climb onto the roof. He had been attempting to sneak back to the cabin when the wolves caught his scent. Opening the side window, Ginger looked out. "Can you hold on?" he yelled.
"No, too cold. Die with cold here,"
came the rather faint reply. The last thing Ginger wanted now was that the Indian should die and carry the secret of the gold to his grave or to the stomachs of the brutes prowling below. There was only one thing he could do. It took him nearly 10 minutes to get the first kick out of one of the propellers. A minute later, the engine started with its customary roar. Ginger didn't bother about the other engine. One would be sufficient for his purpose. In the face of a roaring aero engine, the wolves were soon in full flight. Slowly, alert for any sign of treachery, Ginger taxied the machine right up to the cabin wall and switched off. Covering the Indian with his automatic, he jumped down and picked up the rifle he could now see lying in the snow. "All right," he said curtly. "Come down, but be careful." The Indian slid off the roof, so stiff with cold that he had difficulty in getting to his feet. Ginger took the Indian's knife from his belt and tossed it, with the rifle, into the machine. He kept him covered with the pistol and grimly pointed to the hut. Once inside, Ginger wasted no time. "Now," he said to his prisoner, "I'm going to ask you some questions. Where is the gold?" The Indian did not reply. "You'd better talk, unless you want to go back outside to the wolves," threatened Ginger. "You'll talk anyway, when they try you for murdering Mose," he went on remorselessly. "You killed him, didn't you?"
"Not me. No. Was McBain," flashed back the Indian quickly.
"How do you know?" demanded Ginger.
"He hit Mose with butt of gun. I saw him clean blood and hair off afterwards."
Ginger was more than pleased about this piece of evidence, but he did not pause in his questioning. "So far, so good. But now, where's the gold?" The Indian turned his face towards the cabin stove.
"Under there," he said simply.
It did not take Ginger long to drag the stove aside and reveal a large cavity. Nestled inside were 8 small sacks, each tied and sealed. On every bulging sack was printed the words, "Moose Creek Goldfields, Incorporated." There was only one other thing in the cavity, a small iron object. When Ginger saw the brand of the Moose Creek Company on the base of it, he understood. "A spare seal," he murmured. "So that's how McBain was able to do the trick." The Indian said nothing. He looked far from happy and very weak from the exposure he'd experienced on the roof. Ginger looked around the cabin for some means of warming his failing prisoner. The first thing he saw was a fur coat hanging from a peg on the opposite wall. It gave him a turn at first, for he recognized it at once as McBain's. But Ginger lifted it down, intending to hand it to the Indian. As he took it down, something sharp in the sleeve pierced his forearm. He located the offending object in the turned-up fold of the cuff. and taking it out, regarded it for some moments. An extraordinary expression on his face. Slipping the object quickly back into the turnip, he spread the coat over the shoulders of his prisoner. The Indian hadn't noticed a thing. The night passed as slowly as any Ginger could remember, but at long last the grey dawn for which he had waited shed its feeble light through the window. There had, of course, been no question of sleep, with a dangerous character like the Indian in the room. "Well, come on your feet and we'll get along," ordered Ginger. His thoughts turned briefly to his companions. They must have wondered what's happened to me. "Anyway, Fort Beaver, here I come." Had Ginger known what was happening at Fort Beaver, his cheerful confidence would have received a rude shock. Indeed, the others had wondered what had happened to Ginger. But now, as they stood in the smoke-filled jail, he slipped from their minds. Flames licked hungrily around the walls. "That's the end of it, then," announced Algy calmly. "As Biggle says, we either go out or fry." "Of the two, I prefer to go out," said Biggles.
"And me," nodded Wilkes.
Smoke and flames poured into the room as Delaney threw open the door. A yell went up from outside. "I'll go first," said the constable, and took a running leap out the door. Biggles followed. Almost before his feet touched the ground, many hands seized him and roughly bound his wrists behind his back. The same fate befell the other airmen, and presently they were assembled in the midst of a jubilant marching throng. "Where are they taking us?" Biggles asked Delaney, who was walking beside him, unmolested by the crowd.
"Ain't no sense in telling you lies," answered the constable. "There's a hanging tree on the edge of the aerodrome."
"Thanks," replied Biggles, not without bitterness. The eastern sky was comparatively light by the time they reached the tree. The prisoners were led under a large branch, over which three ropes with nooses were thrown.
"Silly sort of a way to die," complained Algy in a dazed voice.
"No use trying to get the crowd to listen to us, I suppose."
"Not in the slightest," returned Biggles. "Look at them. No, I don't usually give up easily, but I must confess there seems to be no way out of this pickle."
His face was grim as rough hands slipped a large noose around his neck. Turning, he watched the others being treated in the same way, regardless of Delaney's frantic expostulations.
"Keep your eyes on McBain, Delaney," called Biggles loudly. "He's the man who murdered Mose and us."
An expectant hush fell over the crowd.